Welcome to Cybersecurity Where You Are, the Center for Internet Security's podcast. I'm Sean Atkinson, CISO at CIS.
And I'm Tony Sager, Senior Vice President and Chief Evangelist at CIS. Cybersecurity affects us all, whether we're online at home, managing a company, supporting clients, or running a state or local government.
So join us on Wednesdays as we discuss trends and threats, explore security best practices, and interview experts in the industry.
Together, we'll clarify these issues, creating confidence in the connected world. Welcome back to the Center for Internet Security's podcast series, Cybersecurity Where You Are, where we dig into some of the big hot topics in cybersecurity and try to bring a little clarity and a little bit of insight into what's going on from the perspective of CIS, but also more broadly with industry experts. And we had a great topic today. The listener might not know this, but I spent a lot of my time, and same with the two other panelists today, talking about the security of software and software-based systems and, you know, all these kinds of things that are just part and parcel, part of the risk equation that we deal with every day in cybersecurity. So two special guests, let me give them a moment to introduce themselves. First up, Kurt Dukes, EVP of Security Best Practices at CIS. Welcome, Kurt.
Hey, Tony. Pleasure to be on with you. Maybe as a little bit of background, I'm, as Tony said, EVP and General Manager here at the Center for Internet Security. My discipline is in the area of security best practices. Been with CIS for 8 years now. And before that, I spent a little over 3 decades. Yes, I'm that old, at the National Security Agency. And I grew up from a lowly computer scientist to become the last director of information assurance for one of two national security agency missions for that. And then I'd be remiss if I didn't point out that I actually served in uniform. I spent just over 5 years in the United States Air Force. Go Air Force, aim high, fly, fight, win, and all things cyber.
Yeah, a nod to the Air Force, but we know your heart is really with SEC sports, so that's okay. Yeah. Well, welcome, Kurt. It's great to get you on the show here. And also joined by literally one of the legends of computer security, software security, and many other topics in between, Steve Lipner. Steve, introduce yourself. And we don't have a couple of hours here because that's what it would take to do you justice. But just a quick intro for our audience, please.
I'll try to be brief. I'm currently the executive director of SafeCode, which is an industry nonprofit that focuses on software security practices and sharing approaches to building secure software among industry players that have created programs to do that. I've been working in software and computer security, cybersecurity, one place or another for about 55 years, and started with the MITRE Corporation, worked for digital equipment along the way, a little firewall company called Trusted Information Systems, and was the director of software security, responsible for their secure software development process at Microsoft for 15 years, ending in 2015.
Yeah, so you've seen the whole history of the business here, and pretty amazing. We'll explore a little bit of that with you, Steve. And for all the amazing accomplishments and things we respect about you, Steve, you are like the worked example of how not to retire. And so that's the area that I'm not sure I can follow your lead, with all respect intended. But welcome to the show, and thanks for being a part of our team here on this great topic of secure by design. So actually, Steve, let me offer you another challenge, just sort of opening thoughts for the audience on the history of software security and this challenge of the quality and security properties of software, because you've seen more of this than anybody I have worked with, and both from an academic sort of conceptual, theoretical, mathematical basis up to the pragmatic, how do I build better code and everything in between. Just a thought or two to help us open up the conversation.
So, so that's easy. It's easy for me to spend half an hour on that, but I won't. Going back to the 70s and 80s, we kind of thought that that the important things of software for building secure software were, we're making sure the features, the security features were right, and that they were always invoked. So like access control lists or security classifications on systems, what have you. In the 90s, especially, people started to discover that the real weaknesses in software security were implementation errors, or a lot of the weaknesses were implementation errors. And so, you know, that sort of led us to the ecosystem we have today of CVEs, vulnerability reports, weakness attacks on products, you know, the things that you read about in the papers. At Microsoft, that hit us pretty hard in the early 2000s, and it caused us to first to stand down the Windows division and focus them on nothing but doing security reviews for a couple of months with about 8,500 people. And then subsequent to that, for taking some of the practices that we had developed in part during that stand down and integrating them into a documented process that we made mandatory for essentially all the software we delivered. And that's called the Security Development Lifecycle, or SDL. It was created in 2004, and that's probably the first mandatory industry process for secure software development.
Yeah, and I remember that Kurt and I were on the government side of that equation. I can't, Kurt, I don't know if you heard this, but I mean, how many people asked us, is Microsoft serious? Are they, you know, I think so. We can't find anybody from Microsoft because they're all working on security things right now. And it was a massive investment on a really complicated problem, right?
I remember one of my friends who was an industry watcher published a note that, you know, this the Bill Gates Trustworthy Computing email came coincident with the Windows security stand down, the security push we called it, and my friend published a note that said, well, Microsoft has this terrible security problem, and their answer to it is to publish a press release. And then people started to discover that we had, you know, 8,500 people from the Windows division doing nothing but security for a couple of months, and that sort of sent the message to customers, also sent the message to the company that we were serious, because you don't do that lightly.
I think that's something I didn't appreciate, Steve, until you and I got to interact again on the two sides of the equation. It was the scale and complexity, right, of modern software development, you know, from an IT vendor's perspective. And it's not a matter of we just train a few people or buy a new tool or, you know, do a better job with requirements. I mean, there are a lot of moving parts to this. And so it's, as you said, implementation errors became the challenge, not the conceptual stuff. I mean, my first assignment at NSA was in what was called the Computer Security Design Guidance Division, and they handed me a cardboard carton full of papers written by, you know, folks like you, and you could name all the names. It's like, oh gosh, the incredible brain power that was behind, you know, those pre-Orange Book days and all the great, you know, the sort of the models, right, the underpinnings of computer security and computing and operating systems as we know it today. So, but, you know, the history of that is fascinating, but here we are sort of in the modern day. So Kurt, let you kick us off on the topic of secure by design. And so folks like Steve, obviously, this is his life. You and I have been involved in software security for most of our careers easily, and many, many others. But really the trigger, I guess it's fair to say the trigger for CIS was the secure by design activity out of CISA, DHS CISA, became kind of the national message, right, that popped up during the prior administration and helped us crystallize some ideas and start as a launching point. So how about some opening thoughts on what CISA was trying to do, kind of what they produce, and then how we jumped off into what we're doing here at the Center for Internet Security?
Yeah, no, Tony, you got it exactly right. It really was CISA that kind of, if you will, galvanized not only the nation, but I think the world around, you know, secure by design. And that was in 2023. But maybe just a little bit more context on secure by design, you know. And so, you know, I think it was in April of 2020, NIST actually published what is now known as Special Pub 218, and it's really the Secure Software Development Framework. Some thought, man, that was an April Fool's joke by NIST, but in reality, it was they were addressing a problem that we've known about for at least a decade, if not longer. You know, from the earliest days of computer security in that regard, that kind of got renewed focus in 2021 with an executive order, and that was 14028 that really created a federal mandate for secure software development. It referenced back to NIST secure software development framework from that. And then in 2023, CISA actually published their guide or their principles on secure by design as initiative. And really what they were trying to do was draw attention to, you know, why secure by design matters. You know, they were seeing an increase in cybersecurity incidents and that increasingly those incidents are rooted in insecure software design. And that's every vendor, both both in the private sector, but also in government developed software. You know, there are flaws, inherent flaws in that design. And, you know, traditionally we tried to do, we had reactive approaches to how you would address poor software design practices. And that was, you know, by, you know, patching software and making sure that you're in compliance, you know, as part of your cybersecurity program for that. The reality though, is that creates fatigue, you know, without really any real progress in isolating core problems and actually fixing those core problems. And so CISA really kind of helped us focus that and brought a cadence to building to build resilience in both software from the start. I'd also would like to at least point out that in 2024 in Europe, the Cyber Resilience Act became became law, and that's really put a hyper focus on secure by design. And so core to the Cyber Resilience Act is really around vendors having to, if you will, certify their products that it meets certain requirements within, in order to be sold within the European Union as part of that. And so all of these things come together, and that really led the Center for Internet Security to say, well, this is all good guidance, but, you know, how do you actually, you know, measure yourself against one or more of the criteria that's been specified? And so we launched this project, really was just trying to say, can we find a way to actually measure or assess and allow organizations to validate that they met the intent of the secure software development framework before that. So that was kind of how we came together, and a natural partnership formed with Safecode. I mean, we've known you and I have known Steve Lipner for, you know, I hate to say it, Steve, but a few decades now. You know, it's been a great partnership. And with him as the executive director at Safecode, it just became a natural touch point for the Center for Internet Security and Safecode to get together and say, can we actually write a guide to assessing secure by design? And the good news is we succeeded. And we published that guide just a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, and we'll have a reference to that in the show notes for the episode here. But that, you know, and the way we discussed it, Curtis, we kicked this off, and you know, with very close friend Steve and others, is it's kind of on brand for CIS, right? You know, we look at good content, SSDF, for example, and say what's needed is maybe a better way to focus attention. Prioritize and measure progress. And, you know, and it's hard to get these things right. Again, the scale, complexity, and speed, you know, there's no one size fits all. So you have to have a way to say, well, I need high level guidance, but also you can't let everyone just interpret that individually, or you get this chaos, right? There's no way to negotiate trust or confidence that I have in software across multiple vendors. So I think that feels like, you know, that was the goal, and I think the right approach. I would be interested, Steve, in the vendor perspective here, right? So, you know, you've been on the side and you work with companies in Safecode that have to respond to these kinds of noble intention requirements or high level catalogs or so forth, and have to kind of figure out the sweet spot of, you know, what are they trying to, what are they asking for, and what do we do to respond to that? So how did you see that from your perspective?
It's an interesting problem, and you know, and the vendor perspective is, you know, is sort of different. I mean, the important thing about you know, software development, particularly, you know, software security, each vendor is kind of unique. Okay, I mean, they, you know, they have their own platform. They have specific platforms they target. They have different programming languages they use. A lot of C and C++, but you know, but different programming languages. They have chosen different tool suites to do their development and do their security, and so you know those things are sort of unique by vendor. On the other hand, if you look at the sort of an abstract level, you know, the things that they do, the things that are in the NIST SSDF, they're all pretty common. And so the question then, you know, that, so the SSDF has had a lot of enthusiastic uptake in industry because it aligns with real sensible best practices. The problem, you know, how do you tell, how do you demonstrate that you've done it? The thing that we all, you know, or vendors live in terror of is somebody, you know, coming along and saying, okay, here's SSDF requirement PO.3.2, write me a paper that says how you did that. And so, you know, the key thing that we sort of wanted to reflect, and I think this project with CIS has done a good job of that, is that, you know, vendors are each going to use their own, you know, tools and best practices, but all those tools and best practices produce artifacts that are evidence that they're doing what the SSDF said. And so that abstraction sort of led us down the path of what, you know, what do you do and what do you ask about? And the nice thing about the artifacts is that they're natural outcomes of doing secure development. They're not things that you do just to convince some certifier whether you actually did secure development or not.
Right. We're going to come back to that question of artifacts and evidence and, you know, how do I demonstrate, conformance or whatever the right verb is. But a quick message to the audience here. We will be right back. Happy 25 years, CIS. Back in 2000, a bunch of experts from government, academia, and private industry met at the Cosmos Club in D.C.
Their mission was clear: help local communities, businesses, government, and critical infrastructure defend against cyber threats, regardless of budget or expertise.
CIS was born to fulfill that mission.
So, Tony, how have we done so far?
Well, let's take a look at the numbers. We detected and mitigated close to 320,000 cyber events protecting public and private sector organizations.
We also blocked over 3 trillion potential connections to known malicious, suspicious, or otherwise risky sites in defense of critical infrastructure.
In 2024 alone, our guides received 1.5 million downloads for their straightforward, actionable security guidance.
And let's not forget 150 episodes of Cybersecurity Where You Are.
Certainly unforgettable, of course not. And honestly, Sean, that's just the beginning.
Absolutely. It's been an incredible 25 years, and we're just getting started.
The future of cybersecurity is evolving fast, and so are we at CIS.
We may not have all the answers yet,
but we've got the right people, the right mission, and a global community behind us.
So here's to the next 25 years of innovation, collaboration, and impact.
Join us on the journey at cisecurity.org. Okay, we're back. Welcome back to our audience here. Kurt, when we left off, we were talking about this question of, okay, so here's the SSDF. Here's our version of it from CIS in terms of measurements and so forth. This question of evidence. And, you know, both of us, in fact, all 3 of us remember the days, right? Especially when it was a government paid for development. the creation of documents of evidence, whatever the name, theory of compliance, theory of whatever, you know. And it, the idea was, here's what the government says. The vendor does something and they write a term paper to explain why they met the intent of that. And you run into several problems there, right? It's, you have a configuration control problem. Does the argument actually match the development practice? And, you know, does in fact, and so you wind up with this complicated, lots of extra data. And that's clearly something we tried to avoid here, but a little insight to share on the use of artifacts or the way, well, we talked about measurement. What does it mean then to demonstrate what your measurement is, or how we pull that together to make the case that we're meeting the good intentions of the secure by design?
Yeah, no, Tony's a great point. And you know, just to kind of bring it up for up one level very quickly, you know, what I think the value that Safecode and CIS did was, you know, we provide, you know, practical, actionable, you know, guidance for industry based on Secure by Design, not by creating yet another list, but actually using the Secure Software Development Framework, you know, that was created by NIST. I think the, you know, the three major components of what, you know, our guide produced is we actually, you know, talk about the six pillars of Secure by Design, you know, and these are things that, you know, Safecode helped us with, and, you know, and they are, you know, secure software design, secure development, secure default configuration, supply chain security, code integrity, and vulnerability remediation in that regard. And so I think that's kind of putting that in the SFDF into context. The other thing that was really, I think, insightful was that, and again, you know, all praise goes to Safecode, is the creation of what we call development groups, right? And so we created three development groups, DG 1, 2, and 3. And really for each one of them, it sets what would be proportional security, secure by design practices and prioritization for organizations, depending on, you know, the size of the organization and the resources they have available, and how well they've created you know, secure software development practices within that. So DG1 really talks about, you know, off the shelf or open software you know, reliance. You know, DG2 is really around custom and third party integration, and DG3 is really around the major investment in custom software. And, you know, now to your point about evidence of compliance, yeah, I mean, there's lots of things you can demonstrate compliance with those principles and those requirements stipulated in the SFDF. You know, one's, you know, by demonstrating that you've created threat models for the application that you've developed software for. You know, another one is around evidence around, you know, that you embody secure coding standards, many of which that come from Safecode and maybe from other organizations for that. I think Steve alluded a little bit to tool outputs, both static and dynamic analysis tools. That's kind of standard fare today with software development organizations. But just having those outputs and being able to demonstrate that as evidence of embodying Secure by Design, I think, is important. The other two aspects are really around vulnerability reports and root cause analysis. So anytime you develop software, you know, you always want to do some type of red teaming of that software. That creates a vulnerability report, and you want to understand what that, you know, what those vulnerabilities are and what's the root cause for those, so that you can fix the problem once, as opposed to having to endure the pain of an adversary attacking you multiple times because you didn't solve the root cause at the beginning. And then finally, a software bill of materials. Today's modern software applications all are using open source libraries that are available. And so, you know, just for any organization to understand what is the provenance of that software and what third-party, you know, libraries or applications are being used as part of that, software product is very important. And then also from a supply chain perspective, just being able to say, you know, looking at the integrity of different facets of the application and what the providence of that software is, you know. So you want to have these supply chain audits as part of it. So these are all types of compliance evidence that what we tried to do in our guide was actually say, for each one of the SFDF requirements, here's examples of the evidence that you need to demonstrate and show to demonstrate conformance with meeting the intent of that SFDF requirement.
Yeah, and just if I may add,
sure,
that, please. You know, the important thing as we were doing that is we said, you know, here are the natural outputs of doing these things right that you can expect to see. And so, you know, the objective is really to say, you know, I mean, it makes it easy for the vendor or developer, because, you know, these are the things that are going to come out of their process. They're not putting extra effort into quote producing evidence. And the other thing is that it makes it effective, because, you know, what matters is not the document you wrote about it, but rather the fact that you actually did whatever the analysis or the tool run or the test was, and that the outputs were clean. And so it's really good for the effectiveness of the process and good for the efficiency for the vendor.
Yeah, and I, you know, again, in contrast, right, to the early days of computer security, Steve, which you remember well, you know, that was a kind of a dream, right? We'll be able to write mathematically verifiable software that obeys these properties. And so the goal was, you know, known properties, mathematical verification, in some sense, perfection, right? If we did a good job with the requirements, the software would reflect that. That's just unrealistic in today's marketplace, right? Things are changing way too rapidly. There's too many pieces integrated. So it's not a question of perfection. We have to explicitly recognize these are living, breathing, changing things. And so there isn't going to be this, you know, we're going to take this long to get the requirements right. We're going to write the code, give poor smucks like me, you know, months to go look at the code and look for flaws in it. And then, no, we're going to recognize that it's not about pass-fail tests. It's about, can I assert some level of confidence in the development process, in the outputs, in the match of what's really running with what, you know, what the tool says. And I think that all really is much more realistic and executable. And I think that is, you know, it's that's sort of high time we recognize that more directly in these software things. But one thing I really like, and I'll ask your thoughts on this, Steve, is this, because you really drove a lot of this, directly tying together the software development, you know, design practices, production, with the operational live environment. You know, this has been, the idea was in the past was, we'll write the software, and then they'll go use some configuration, the CIS benchmark or a NSA security guide or whatever, but those are separate things. And we've really tried, I think, tied them together here, right, to say, let's make sure that we have a process to track the flaws and integrate that into our development so we don't repeat those flaws, you know, the example that Kurt gave. But how that ties together and how?
So a couple of things that are important. One of them, you know, as Kurt said, and, you know, I always hammer on this when I talk about secure development, you know, the root cause analysis and continuous improvement are incredibly important, just because that's how you tell, you know, what mistakes you're making and how you keep from reliving that experience over and over and over again. That's one thing. To talk directly to you know, sort of the synergy with the CIS controls, there are two places that comes into play. First, when you're delivering software, you want it to be operationally secure. And so one of the things you do, one of the six areas that we talk about in the paper, one of the six considerations is secure by default. And that really ties to, you know, sort of the CIS control configuration. What do you give to the system administrator to be sure that they can operate this software securely? And if they don't look at every knob and switch, you know, it'll still be resistant to attack. The other important overlap with the controls is that, you know, one of the other considerations that we talked about was code integrity, basically the protection of the code under development and in distribution. And there you're really, you know, basically applying the CIS controls to your development environment to make sure that the, you know, the repositories are protected, that only the right people are accessing and changing the code, and that everything you're doing is auditable, so that you can go back and see where, you know, if a problem was introduced maliciously, you have some opportunity, some possibility of investigating that. So those are, you know, it's really, really a good overlap. I mean, the partnership with CIS has worked out great.
No, those are two amazing examples, and right on the money. You know, this idea of I have to protect my development environment, and there's lots of complexity with that, and lots of, you know, examples of when you don't do that. But and also that that notion of if this becomes by default, right? And this was kind of the maybe early mid 2000s dream. Remember the U.S. Air Force desktop and the federal desktop core configuration. That is, if I could make this default, then not only do I get those desirable properties, but now I can turn to my developers and say, you know, you're part of the acceptance test is it runs on a well-configured system that has known security properties. And therefore I can, you know, if you do that up front, that's so much easier than after the fact to say, well, wait a minute, I can't run this piece of software without undoing all my security controls. Well, why is that? Well, because I didn't say anything to the vendor, right, about what's the target environment going to be, other than a wide open Windows box, for example. So those are both so essential. And again, I think it really speaks to, you know, a more holistic look at this question of software security, right? At the end of the day, we're going to run it. We're going to run enterprises. We're going to protect information. And so both have to be there. And then this, defining this cycle of improvement is, you know, is exactly right to recognize that these are living, breathing things. And so you need a process in place to manage all that. So Kurt, this is a pretty ambitious, you know, again, having that, we all have this, I don't know how many, we must be approaching a couple decades among the three of us here in all this kind of stuff. So the paper was released, you said, what, a couple weeks ago, right? Any early reactions, any interest, any complaints? What are we hearing so far?
Yeah, no. The good news is no complaints.
Excellent.
and if there were, you know, we would actually cheerfully take all criticism of the document, and, you know, we would then look to update the guide. There were a couple things that, you know, we, you know, in order just to get the guide out, we made a conscious decision not to include, but there will be an update to the guide, not based on criticism, mind you, but just an update to the guide.
But we're open to it.
Exactly, to include other aspects of it. You know, we briefed the our efforts within Europe and at the European Technical Standards Institute at their security conference. Got a lot of good positive feedback on it. We've been talking with the UK, the National Cybersecurity Center, and kind of, you know, making sure that we're all in alignment with this. And we're actually looking to take what we've done in our guide and actually create a European standard through ETSI, and then maybe that would be part of some of the you know, criteria around the Cyber Resilience Act for that. And so far the, you know, the feedback has been, you know, very very positive, you know, from government and maybe to a lesser extent industry. I mean, but Tony, you do it bodes the question is, well, what are some of the key takeaways, right? You know, and I think from our lens, it's really around, it's a shared responsibility between, you know, developer and, you know, and company leadership in that regard. And frankly, you do have to invest in secure processes. And the reality of that is it does reduce long-term risk and the compliance burden. So I think, you know, industry is going to want to be able to follow the SFDF and maybe use our assessment guide as a means for actually show to demonstrate conformance for that. And then the other key takeaway is really it's any type of evidence-based assurance. Really, it helps build customer and regulator trust in the quality of the software being produced by that by the manufacturer for that. And so I think those are some of the takeaways, and I think there's an opportunity for that. The paper really is a call to action. We really want software manufacturers to actually embody and use the Secure Software Development Framework as articulated by NIST. Maybe use Safecode and CIS have created in the assessment guide, and actually start voluntarily demonstrating that they meet the intent according to whatever development group they're in, that they met the intent of SFDF according to that development group.
Exactly right. I mean, even if an organization has a secure development process in place, why the guide and the SSDF are a useful check to make sure basically that they thought of everything, the evidence is things that they can look at and look for internally and say, are we really doing this? And if they're not, it's not like, some out of band thing. It's something that they do, and producing the evidence produces more secure software. So that's really the mindset. And then from the customer perspective, whether to what extent and whether you expose that sort of thing to customers is up to, the vendors and contracts and so on. But at least you have confidence, if the customer can somehow have confidence that the vendor is actually producing those things, then that's meaningful assurance that can be beneficial.
No, both of those are our goals, thanks for the nod, Kurt, to we'll call it object reuse in this stuff. We've learned this over decades, right? And I often say computer security has been around long enough. It's hard to have a unique problem or an original thought. A lot of really smart people have given this a lot of thought over decades, our entire careers. And so to not make use of the SSDF, right, the good work from NIST, which included industry experts like Steve, why would you try to recreate that from scratch? It makes no sense at all. Now, you can bring it down a notch, right, in a sort of prescriptive level, define measurements, talk about evidence, which is what we really try to do. But there's no reason to sort of start over again. And yet so many things we do in computer security, cybersecurity, have that flavor of, well, we're special, we're unique. We couldn't use it because they use it in that industry, or that's in the US and that's not, it doesn't apply to us or whatever. And I think we try to get past all that and blend together, but also decide what should be prioritized and help people get started, right? And work to the level that they're really equipped to deal with it, what is the target that they're aiming for. Steve's point is really an important one about the evidence, will be something that's dealt with through contracts and requirements and all that kind of stuff. But I think we can have confidence, success might look like, right, using our work as a roadmap or an entryway into the larger SSDF as a way to guide the development practices. As Steve said, checklists are not evil. They remind us of all the things, right, in a really complicated multivariable situation, that we don't miss anything, that we don't miss the lessons of the past. And that gives us a way to organize and structure a development program, which I think is really key to this. And then this focus on evidence that comes as a byproduct of development. I think these are all, really important ideas and things that we try to honor as principles when we put this together. For the audience, if you're not used to the way we operate, we try to figure out ahead of time. I know this is a little strange. What are we trying to achieve, and what are the principles that will guide our discussion, right? And in security, and we've all been in those discussions, it's so easy to overachieve, ask for more evidence because we can, just in case, so I feel a little bit better about it, so that I can't be blamed that I missed something and therefore, I'd be responsible for negative outcomes. So I feel pretty good about that. But anyway, so great stuff, great work. I look forward to more feedback on the paper. As Curtis shared, there'll be another edition or so. But these are, again, we could have spent another year and polished it up a little finer, or we could just put it out there. And I think we hit the mark pretty well. And I think the early feedback tells us that. Any last thought, Kurt, from the executive position at CIS on
Yeah, now, if you don't mind, maybe just two thoughts. First one is, you know, to my good friend Steve Lipner, I'll have to chide him just a little bit. And that is, you know, when I first proposed that we create a guide for measuring secure by design, I think Steve thought I was crazy. I'd actually gone to the loony farm. But over a few weeks and months, maybe, you know, and a few emails, Steve came around, and I got to tell you, I valued the partnership, and to our audience, you know, Steve is just a fountain of knowledge when it comes to secure software development. And so CIS could not have done this without Safecode. So Steve, thank you. And thank you for actually listening, you know, taking what would make a weird idea and actually making it into something that actually looks like a common sense approach. And then my second point, and this is just a foot stomp, a comment from Steven, you know, the point about having evidence doesn't mean you actually have to always show it. And because frankly, some customers just want the, you know, the feeling that you're attesting against some type of a set of requirements. There's going to be other customers, you know, on the higher end, maybe Fortune 100, Fortune 50 companies that they're going to say, well, I actually want to see some of the evidence. And that's the good news is what I think what we've kind of create through SFDF actually has that and on demand that could be made available from software manufacturers. So that's kind of where I'll leave it at, and I'll hand it over to Steve. So.
All right, Steve, any last thought for the audience here?
Well, first comment, you know, I mean, I did have that reaction when proposed me, but what I'm going to claim is, you know, what I, you know, well, Kurt, what you really meant to ask for was this.
Well played, Steve. Yes,
and second, more seriously, you know, the Safecode has really we've worked with CIS before on a couple of things, and we've really valued that partnership, and it's been very, very helpful in terms of getting feedback, getting a different perspective, getting a complementary technical set of perspectives, and that's just been very beneficial to us and to, I think, to the people who consume the guidance. I think other than that, you know, Kurt and Tony have nailed it. I hope folks have a good idea of what we've done, and I'd encourage them to download the guide.
Yep, absolutely. And you know, it's part of the charm of CIS. We're pretty accessible. If you want to get to the authors, you know, you're looking at a significant percentage of the team right here. But you know, these are community products, right? Things that we put out there, and these are not the product of giant think tanks, but you know, they represent the experience of folks like us and our friends, our partners, and other nonprofits and government friends. So we appreciate all the help. And again, there's no business model for CIS without this large scale volunteerism that really is, you know, part of the entire ecosystem of cybersecurity. So with that, we'll wrap this up. There'll be more to talk about as this matures and we move on to the next thing. And Steve, I have to echo your that's well played, because I'm on the receiving end of Kurt's charm offensive as he tries to convince me of something, and it's you know, his standards of discussion are high, which keeps us all sharp. So we really appreciate that also. So with that, we'll wrap this episode up. Thank you to the audience. We always, as always, we appreciate your time and attention. I look forward to sharing topics and great guests with you sometime in the future. Subscribe to this podcast in all the usual ways, and we'll catch you again next episode. Thank you all. Thank you for listening to the podcast today.
The thoughts and opinions expressed by our podcast guests are solely theirs and do not necessarily reflect those of CIS.
Tune in on Wednesdays for a new episode.
And in the meantime, visit our website at cisecurity.org.
Together, we'll continue our efforts of creating confidence in the connected world.